Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. Welcome to Desert Oracle Radio Replay. I'm Roxana, and I've been traveling all over the state, gathering information for shows to come. I'm still traveling, as a matter of fact, so this week I have a couple episodes that might have you appreciating our somewhat cool early summer. Our first episode today was produced by Ken Lane, June 14th, 2019. It covers swamp coolers, which you might want to think about when the temperatures soar this summer, and you know they will. Here is Keep Cool or Die.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the Mojave and it went right ahead and got hot. Without asking, as usual. Nobody asked if we were tired of the crisp nights and the bright sunny days still pleasant enough for morning walks, sundown hikes, etc. But at least we've still got plenty of baby animals bouncing around, little jackrabbits and cottontails. A whale, mourning doves, plenty of little hummingbirds, and noisy cactus wrens picking bugs out of the screen door loud as they can. Nobody yells like a cactus wren when you disturb it in some way. Such as by walking past the cactus wren and not bothering it in any way whatsoever. Rack, 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 it yells at you. And when it is done hollering at you, it flies off in a huff. And you know, most of those bugs are stuck in the screen because I go through a lot of candles every night, and you know how the moth goes to the flame and all that. Now, last week I mentioned getting the swamp cooler going to deal with the new seasonal reality of the hot times up here in the Mojave. And a couple of people mentioned to me that they did not know what a swamp cooler was, or they knew sort of what it was, or they knew it by a different name. Now, most of these queries were from Ireland and England and France, it should be noted, and swamp coolers do not work over there. That's why the early swamp cooler repairmen emigrated to the deserts of the New World so many centuries ago. Now, the swamp cooler is a wonderful and simple machine. I used to work on the things many years ago. They're so simple that you can put any idiot on the job. It's a box, usually a box made of thin sheets of metal, sometimes out of fiberglass. And there are big square or rectangular pads attached to the vent panels, and these pads are kept damp by a little drip of water from a little hose. And that water is mostly recycled from the bottom of the pan and goes up and down over the pads again. It's like some back-asswards fish aquarium when you think about it, but very economical. To service a swamp cooler, you just take off the vent panels and you replace the pads if you have tighten the fan belt, maybe dig some poor old dried up dead pack rat out of there, throw it down on whoever's at the bottom of the ladder, your comrade. Sometimes you just have to hose out the pads, hose off the pads in the driveway, get all the sand and filth and black widows and whatever else out of there. You know, we call them swamp coolers because the pads used to be made from Spanish moss. Spanish moss that you pulled down from the cypress trees in the swamplands of the American South. People used to use that moss for stuffing pillows and car seats and all kinds of stuff. It's all natural, it's very strong, it's resistant to rot. But when it finally gets worn out and you're done with it, you just compost it, bury it, throw it on the ground. Now the pads are made of plastic or of aspen fiber, which works very nicely, but it needs to be replaced more often because the wood fiber starts coming apart in the cooler. And then there are those honeycomb paper or cardboard ones you use in those nice big Master Cool swamp coolers. If you're in the desert and it's not monsoon season yet and your swamp cooler is not keeping you cool, clean the pads, maybe replace the pads, maybe get a whole house swamp cooler, one that will fill the whole place with nice cool air all summer long. Until monsoon season. Well, what makes a swamp cooler work, and what makes it work so well, so cheaply, and with such low use of energy and minimal use of water? Well, it's magic. Some people call it evaporation. When your swamp box fan is pulling the hot, dry outside air over your damp swamp cooler pads, the water in the pads pulls heat out of the air as the hot air turns the water to vapor, water vapor. And that now cool and humidified air blows into your cabin or your metal shop or your art studio or your coffin factory or wherever it's blowing. And you delight in the cool breeze. It also keeps your skin and your lips from cracking like desert pavement. And when that little tray of water at the bottom of the swamp box has evaporated, a little $20 electric pump like you'd have in a tropical fish aquarium turns itself on and a little more water goes in there, very efficient. But better yet, it's very refreshing. Air conditioning uses a lot of electricity and chemicals to blow hard, dry, semi-cold air into your house. Sometimes they're necessary. Like when monsoon season comes around early and stays around. Then the air is too humid for the swamp cooler. You need warm, dry air to get the benefit of a swamp cooler. That's why they don't have them down south where the Spanish moss grows. The higher the humidity, the less effective your evaporative cooler. Below about 30% relative humidity, your swamp cooler is going to keep you very comfortable when it's 110 Fahrenheit outside. But as the humidity climbs, the swamp cooler loses its ability to lower the inside temperature. So, when it's muggy outside, just forget it. Now, for a long time, I believed the swamp cooler was an invention of the American desert. There's such a ubiquitous sight upon the roof of every humble desert home, especially that mid-20th century version, that calcified and half-rusted metal box sort of barely hanging on up there. Decades of hardened and crispy black tar slapped around the vent hole. That wedge of discoloration fanning down the gable side of the roof had a TV dish bleached white by the sun, and it seems like something very much of our time. But evaporative coolers have been around as long as humans have built cities in the desert, and as humans built the first cities in the desert, as human civilization was born of the desert, created by the desert. Evaporative cooling is some of the very oldest technology to be used in permanent human settlements. In ancient Egypt, in ancient Persia, and Babylon. These grand old ancient cities had slender towers of brick that would catch the desert breeze and direct it over pools of water beneath the buildings. And vents would carry this cool breeze through the palaces, through the temples. And whenever we talk about humans and technology, it's always useful to think about which humans were doing the installation of the swamp coolers. The building of these cities. The baking of the bricks and the baking of the bread. It sure wasn't the king or the queen or the priest. They weren't doing any work. They were sitting inside, presiding over an altar, fine rugs spread beneath them, the air fragrant with incense. The king was not up there sweating on the roof. I remember my dad coming down off the roof of some suburban mansion or another in Phoenix and gulping down salt tablets with a quart of water and cursing that he had to go back up there and finish. Finish the job. Life or death up there. To keep it nice in the house below, to keep it nice in the house below for the soft pink humans inside. Who would come out from the Chicago suburbs or the Detroit suburbs to get away from the wintertime. Anyway, that's quite enough about swamp coolers, but keep them in mind when you're fixing up your place in the desert. They make summer very tolerable. And you won't be spending many hundreds of dollars per month on the electric bill, which is what air conditioners want from you, air conditioners and the death economy that makes them. And they want your money and they want carbon and all kinds of chemical pollutants pumped into the atmosphere, so it keeps getting hotter and hotter down here. Second season of Desert Oracle Radio. A few more to go, and it seems like every week I want to get to this stack of letters and postcards, and we always run out of time. So let's just make the time tonight. I love getting your letters, and here are some real good ones. Let's see, this is a postcard from San Francisco. I first came upon Desert Oracle at a bar in 29 Palms, passing through town with a band. I've really been enjoying the magazine and the podcast. Please continue both as long as you are interested in the desert. Signed, Matt J. P.S. Please excuse my terrible handwriting. This one is a postcard from the Center for Land Use Interpretation up in Nevada. It says, another card from the center. They only send these to me when they want money. Now it's yours to enjoy. Jack Freer, Reno, Nevada. nice letter. It says, morning, evening, or maybe afternoon, whenever it is you get to this note, I hope it finds you well, my friend. Caught the radio show last night, a damned good one, though I must admit that the longer I live in the Mojave, the more I find the UFO jabber to be ridiculous. But I still love it. And the way I love a good ghost story reminds me of a night at the Amargosa Opera House, but it can be hard to look past the absurdity of some of the personas involved in the spread of the lore. Still, every time Jay Bird and I venture out into the wilds, we look up at the sky in hopes of seeing something wild. Forgive the fickle ink, my typewriter ribbon is dry, and I don't nurture this old machine as much as I oughta. Anyway, thought I would send you a few photos in case you need any. Here's a desert tarantula found behind the cabin here in Blue Diamond. I nearly flattened him underfoot as I was running trails. But he advertised his regal presence on the just rained upon canyon floor. There is a Mojave endemic species. And well, it just sort of fades out here. Let me go ahead. 18 of the tarantula group live in California, Nevada, and Arizona. And I have been blessed, or cursed, to witness the raw fury of a pitched battle between tarantula and tarantula hawk. I was wandering the dunes of the Palin Mountain area near Blythe when I saw the monstrous spectacle. It would take pages to properly tell, but I think it's sufficient to say that I was deeply moved and humbled by the raw oddity of the event. Until next time, keep up the holy work. As ever, Sea del Desierto. Now here we have a postcard with a picture of the Alabama Hills on the front. On the other side, greetings, Desert Oracle, writing this while camped at Trona Pinnacles, not the Alabama Hills, which was the perfect place to listen to your show about the Pleiades. It was also a perfectly terrifying place to hear the segment about desert crypto beasts like Yucca Man, especially when the dog stood stock still, staring into the distance, hackles raised all down his back. And all I could see was a set of glowing eyes. But thanks for all your work, both printed and audio. Cheers from JG and Gus, subscribers. Dear Desert Oracle, I put the podcast on for my dad a few months back as we drove to Moab from Salt Lake. It prompted him to tell me about his time in the 1950s on Bill Key's ranch. He used to go out there with his stepfather's stepson, ? And the stepson was in his late 20s. My dad was about 10 years old at the time and was often called upon to drive as the stepson would get wasted with his pals in the back seat of their Packard. He remembers being rewarded for guarding the car outside a bar for hours in the heat with an A&W root beer float. The stepson and pals worked for Bill Keys while my dad lived in a hut constructed of World War II ammo crates. He was given food every couple of days and patrolled Keyes' place with his BB gun. He met Keyes a few times. Thanks for conjuring this story out of my dad. Eric, KT, Utah. Dear Desert Oracle and Ken Lane, I am writing to tell you how much I appreciate you and the podcast. I admire greatly your ability to collage information, cynicism, and humor on the backdrop of a well-crafted soundscape. I am a contemporary artist making work about the environment and conservation, and your work inspires me. For a couple more months, I'm living in Escalante, Utah. And at the risk of sounding bold and creepy, I'd like to let you know that you're welcome to visit. I'd really like to meet you someday, and I'm saying this to you because I doubt you wound up meeting Edward Abbey by accident. Thanks again, Shane Skopatz. You know, that's true. It was not an accident. I did not run into Edward Abbey on some dusty trail. I went to see him speak in La Jolla with a bunch of other nuts. Now here we have one from, this is from Zenko J.R. Montgomery to Ken of the Desert. This is your monastic fan, Jordan Zen Tiger Montgomery. Near a month ago, my partner and I had a cocktail with you before your monthly steak dinner. We very much appreciated your strange and terrible campfire stories that night. I heard the most recent submission to the old Oracle mailbag and thought a heartening missive would be welcome. This evening we are back in the Mojave, parked in our sand-pocked camper van off Furnace Creek Wash Road in Death Valley. Good view of the borax mines. The night is black, true black. The strange clouds this week blocking out the stars. In a few weeks, we'll be married. Is the rain pattering down on us now a good omen in May? Or another sign that all things change, our lives and the Earth's climate not exempted? We are returning from our big loop, Eastern Terminus Durango. The day after your stories, we broke down and spent a hellish night along the interstate in Palm Springs. Climbed up Queen Mountain from both sides, Boy Scout Trail and a Karn-marked dirtbag trail on the south. 8 hours hiking in Joshua Tree National Park without seeing another knuckle-dragger. Attempted a direct assault straight up Kelso Dune at high noon and were totally defeated, spiritually and physically. But we did hear the goblin songs. Urinated into a vortex in Sedona during a magnificent storm, caught a plainclothes ranger at Petrified Wood in that Crystal Grove. Spent a few nights in revelry with Zenny's in Albuquerque. Got wicked, debilitating food poisoning at a little place called... We'll skip the name of that restaurant. Everybody has bad days. Retired to the mountains to recover in the good thin air from Mesa Verde. And then it kind of trails off, and he says, I don't know where I was going with this. My little battery-powered light flickered out. It's 3 weeks later in Berkeley, so far away from the red rocks we enjoyed in the Canyonlands. Arches is a radioactive industrial tourist zone, not dissimilar from Zion. We did not even stop in Zion, as their parking lots were all teeming. Anyway, this is a letter, or was a letter, that had the intention of thanking you and inviting you to come up to Tassajara again. There are times when you could, we'll leave out this private information, and there's also the option of, well, that's a good option, I'm going to leave that out as well. Well, Zenko Jordan, I want to thank you for this very nice letter, and I'll answer this one off the air. It is always so nice to find something other than another enormous bill from the printers when I visit Post Office Box 1735 here in Joshua Tree. So please do keep your cards and letters coming. We do love them. And if you can't find a pen or you don't own any paper, we're at DesertOracle.com. From Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. We broadcast from KCDZ FM in Joshua Tree and on fine community radio stations up and down the West Coast through Public Radio Exchange. The soundscapes you hear on tonight's program are by Joshua Tree's own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. You can get the podcast of this broadcast wherever you get podcasts. Try telling that Spotify thing, play Desert Oracle Radio. It'll do it. You know, Brother Jay forwarded a news story from our local newspaper announcing that the power may be cut off to various parts of the high desert throughout the summer to evade wildfire danger or to evade the electrical grid starting residential fires. Boy, that is not going to be fun at all. Might be a good time to get off the grid, put up some more solar panels, and run your own thing. The electric grid, like so much of our modern world, has become a liability. Probably in 10, 15 years, nobody will even remember what the electric grid was. Hopefully, it will be forgotten, not because we're hiding deep beneath the surface of the earth, but because we've come up with something a lot better. We'll come up with something better. Hang in there. Thank you for listening. As always, we do appreciate it. And good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM. Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM and streaming online at kgvm.org. I'm hoping your weekend has been a good one. Well, next up, we have a show Ken produced June 12th, 2020. And just like today, there was a lot of discontent in the air. Here is If It's Broke, Fix It.
Ha ha ha!
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and you know I've always been fascinated by people who have a lot of arcane knowledge. A speciality. The woman who knows everything about owls. Which requires a lot of knowledge about everything to do with owls. And raptors in general. Wilderness and farmland. Pesticides and climate change. Rodents in particular. Evolutionary biology, night and day, eyes and optics, multiple detailed levels of local, state, national, and international laws and conventions having to do with owls and all the things that cross over with owls. Forest and forestry, timber and watersheds, light pollution and trail cameras, public databases and private endowments. The owl in folklore and folk song, indigenous and ancient religion, literature and poetry and philosophy and pop culture, the archetype of the wise owl, the wisdom goddesses and their owl familiars. Athena, Minerva, St. Bridget. That's right. I mentioned St. Minerva. The white goddess, the essence of true wisdom. The black Madonna. The great owl eyes that see into the inner soul. You know, their time of power is dusk. And you know, the Navajo know that the owl is the envoy between worlds. The owls are not what they seem. And yet they are exactly what they seem. Creatures of mystery, even when you're an expert, even then. You are out in the night squinting through military goggles to get a clumsy glimpse of what the owl sees with perfection and clarity and high-speed processing ability. Highly specialized, totally intuitive. You know, there is much more to know and much more to do to improve the situation for the owls and for the world the owls need. The owls and us both. And so you keep at it. You publish papers in the biology journals, and you watch YouTubes of other owl experts talking about owls, and no doubt you have a lot of owl totems wherever you live. Even if you don't want them, you have them because people think, well, let's get her this owl whatever. This owl painting, or these ice trays that make little owl ice cubes. Or for sure, this owl t-shirt and the owl tote bag. And some owl yard ornaments. And maybe, weird old Aunt Carol says, I don't know if you want this, but since Frank died, I figured I'd give away all his junk. And he's got this taxidermied owl. I think it's an owl. And all that is just to know everything about owls. To try to know, anyway. The fun is being out in the field and witnessing some oddball behavior. Like a great horned owl hunting cooperatively with a pair of desert iguanas. Totally unheard of. The iguanas are hanging off the owl's tail, I guess, and now they're coming in low over a herd of night rats, and you're seeing all of this on the night vision cameras. 8K, well, they can get 6 or 10 rats at a time like this, so it's much more efficient, time-wise. Now, the iguanas don't eat live rats, so there's apparently a barter system, because what the desert iguana really does eat is its own crap. I mean, you can look it up. The desert iguana eats fecal pellets of its own species, which aids in the digestion of plant cellulose by establishing the proper gut fauna. Whatever, respect the kink. So the owls, well, they have some system whereby they collect the iguana crap when the iguanas aren't looking or otherwise occupied, and then, well, nobody knows. Nobody knows how they communicate. Perhaps they've learned each other's language, as so many of us have done with dogs or whatever. Ravens. Babies. You ever hear some parents and their new baby is just jabbering a bunch of horrific sounds? Like you don't know if it's hurt or what? If something clamped onto its foot, and the mother will say, "Oh, that just means he wants the iPad." Really? But they figured it out. They figured out if you give the baby the iPad, it'll stop making that sound. Is this comprehension of another language or just a mutual Pavlovian reinforcement? We used to say, don't give the baby the iPad, it'll wreck the baby's brain. But we finally quit saying that because it's all most of us do anyway. The baby is now being prepared for a lifetime of looking at a phone, looking at a screen, looking at the TV. So, like Generation Z right now, that baby will grow up to hate the terrible, banal, backwards world the old people created. The world of contact tracing, shopping screens in everybody's hands all the time, and we even pay for it. We pay for the privilege. We've come to a weird point in time when we wait for some external entity to tell us what to do, tell us what we're allowed to do. Give us a job and then take it away again. Give us health insurance or a place to live and then take that away. Give us a little bit of liberty and a whole lot of death, hard and mean. Now, if you look at the Old West, the Wild West, the Desert Southwest of 1865 through 1895, really through the end of the 1800s and already mythologized and legendary by 1900, here you see what happened when people got tired of being told what to do, told who they were and what they could be. In the movies, the cowboys are usually tall white dudes like Gary Cooper. But of course, you know, the real cowboys tended toward the small and lean size. They could ride any kind of horse from a pony to a draft horse. Why, they could tame wild mustangs on the Great Basin Desert and the juniper hills of New Mexico, the grasslands of what we call Texas and Oklahoma today. The Plains Indians, the Comanche and Apache, Crow and Blackfoot, they all led the way in that department, having helped themselves to some Spanish stock left behind or liberated from the expeditions from Mexico City, Coronado, and etc. The horse plays a big part and the native history of the second half of the second millennium. Vaquero, that got garbled into buckaroo. That's what they called the horsemen of the old Spanish, Mexican, and Californio ranchos. The business was cowhide, shipped out by the tens of thousands when the United States muscled in. A flood of people followed, 49ers and veterans of both the winning and losing sides of the rebellion, as did so many formerly enslaved peoples who got a look at the new situation and realized, especially in the defeated South, that the law can change on paper, but it doesn't mean it changes on the ground, on the soil. So our tougher-than-leather cowboys and occasional cowgirls comprised all the colors and cultures of the Americas. Better to be free on the range on the back of a horse, and if somebody treated you poorly, well, you could just go to another town. And if somebody treated you very poorly, well, guns were cheap and so were bullets. Some 10-star on a white man's shirt meant zero, as it should. A 10-star is a momentary decoration in designation of a momentary public servant. Now, back then, the sheriff was a very temporary sort of job, and nobody had any illusions about it. They were generally criminals themselves, shut out of honest work by their disposition and personal history. And their paid duty was solely to keep the peace and keep out other criminals. When they failed, they were fired. When they really failed, they were buried beneath a flimsy wooden cross and a pile of rocks behind the whorehouse. And when they disgraced themselves and disgrace the town, well, then they were thrown to the hogs, the vultures, good riddance to bad rubbish. I want to tell you about a radical and inspirational approach to protecting our communities, our people, and our wildlife, and our open spaces, and our air and water, especially in our beloved little desert and mountain towns in the West. Because that's where this one originated. And as modern and exciting and of the moment it sounds, this policy proposal by a candidate for sheriff is from 1970, 50 years ago, a half century ago. The place? The classic western town of the era. The place to be. The Joshua Tree and Sedona and Park City of its time. Aspen, Colorado. The candidate was part of a radically progressive slate of candidates, teachers, artists, attorneys, and doctors, and writers dedicated to basic human rights, basic decency, an unpolluted world for themselves and their kids and their friends and their families. Having seen the local sheriff's deputies habitually mistreat the peaceful young people drawn to Aspen's beauty and sense of community, these reformers aim to take over every aspect of local government, city and county political offices, including coroner, mayor, supervisors, and of course the sheriff's department. And they did not simply propose fresh faces, some minor reforms. They proposed, with intense community input and clarity, completely remaking the institutions that no longer serve the people. If elected, the new sheriff would not even serve in a law enforcement capacity. Instead, this sheriff would serve as ombudsman for a six-pronged department dedicated to volunteer service, citizen complaints, consumer protection, legal aid, training and hiring and overseeing of a small policing branch, and a public information bureau to shine light upon it all for the benefit of all. Serving at the pleasure of the elected sheriff and the community at large would be an undersheriff who would manage the essential public services of search and rescue, traffic safety, court summons, investigation, and finally, policing. which would be done with maximum transparency and without the violence and intimidation that had already tarnished the community for so many of its citizens. The campaign was unique for making law enforcement a relatively small part of the sheriff's department. As the candidate said, "I plan to expand the scope of the sheriff's office to encompass the prevention and elimination of the causes of crime, as well as merely dealing with the effects of it after the fact. The younger generation regards police as the enemy. I envision a self-policing committee, especially among the young people, so that the word is put out that no heroin, speed, or burglaries, etc. will be allowed in the community." Now, the most revolutionary part of this sheriff's campaign was its intense focus on the kind of crime that affects most of us, both then and now: environmental crime. Take a look at the death tolls in this rotten pandemic we're in. Black Americans are far more likely to die from COVID-19 than white Americans. In some communities, black people are dying 2 to 3 times more often from the same virus. Latino communities are hit hard too, because these communities are so often the poor communities, the black and brown neighborhoods, because of a system that's rotten from the fish head down. Poor health, often non-existent medical insurance, run-down neighborhoods with the dirtiest air, the unsafe drinking water supplies. Low income, high unemployment. No Whole Foods or farmers markets. Redlined out of home ownership. Redlined out of park budget, city landscaping, proper school facilities, color lined right out of blue skies and green belts. This is the environmental apartheid of America. Crimes against our environment rank as high crimes against people. Law enforcement must detect both. This new sheriff's department would have environmental law deputies with environmental science backgrounds. They would travel not with an arsenal of human-killing weapons, but would test for soil, water, air, maps, cameras for the prosecution of illegal dumping, poisoning of streams and sky, poaching of wildlife, and clearing of timber. If you're thinking, well, we already have people to investigate and prosecute such things, first of all, we did not in 1970. The Federal Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, and other such green legislation, all still a couple of years away. Even the Environmental Protection Agency would not be chartered until the end of that year, December of 1970. Now, to the older people, the squares, the good Germans, etc., all of this sounded radical. To the young people, of course, it made perfect sense. They saw the world as it was, not as it had been. They saw that everything is always up for grabs and that every now and then good people are inspired to go ahead and take it. Not for riches, not for power over oppressed people in their communities, but to spread it around, give it back, make it safe, make it a public good, the public good. A number of activists, environmental attorneys, shaped the platform based on their experience with local and regional defense leagues that had begun springing up around the country. Many inspired by marine biologist Rachel Carson's revolutionary bestseller of 1962, Silent Spring. Here is how this sheriff's campaign from 50 years ago pledged to deal with crimes against our shared and localized environment. Every law enforcement deputy would be trained equally in preventing and detecting both environmental crime and the typical person property crimes. If you think that would overwhelm a deputy, remember that it takes just a few weeks, maybe a few months of training to go from unemployed to a gun and a badge in a squad car. George Floyd's murderers had been flipping burgers at McDonald's and collecting shopping carts at Walmart immediately before they were sent out to terrorize black communities. It doesn't have to be like this. Anything we don't like, guess what? We change it. The candidate in question, all those years ago, lost his election by a handful of votes, as did the equally forward-thinking candidate for mayor of Aspen. But within a very short time, many of their proposed radical changes became both law and practice. Not enough, of course, but they were right, and they almost got to prove it themselves that time. The sheriff's candidate left his own important mark on the American literary tradition of the hell-raising voice of moral outrage, generally wrapped in humor and storytelling. And he left his own peculiar mark on the Mojave Desert with his 1971 literary classic of madness in the face of fascism, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Written shortly after he lost a sheriff's race, written mostly on a weekend vacation from covering the Chicano movement in Los Angeles, and what most believe to be the deliberate murder of Chicano journalist Ruben Salazar by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. They shot him in the head with a tear gas projectile. He was sitting inside the Silver Dollar Bar on Whittier Boulevard, having a cold beer and getting a moment's rest from the violence outside. Chicanos were peacefully protesting the Vietnam War on the streets, but then the busloads of heavily armed, militarized deputies showed up. Look it up. You can read along on Wikipedia with me. The sheriff's deputy fired a 10-inch wall-piercing type of tear gas round from a tear gas gun of the type intended for barricade situations, rather than the type of tear gas round designed to be fired directly at people, which produces a plume of tear gas smoke. The LA coroner ruled Salazar's death a homicide, a murder. But the cops were never prosecuted. Salazar's friend and attorney, Oscar Acosta, was helping this Aspen-based writer get a sense of the heartbreak and rage within the Chicano community. And this is when the former sheriff's candidate and the social justice attorney decided to go to Vegas for the weekend, to drive through the desert and talk it out, to blow off some steam. You probably know by now that the candidate for sheriff of Aspen was Hunter S. Thompson. But you might not know that Los Angeles County paid out $700,000 1970 money to Ruben Salazar's family for his wrongful death, which was at the time the largest cash settlement in LA County history. Now, Hunter Thompson has fallen out of favor over the years, but that's mostly because a strange frat boy contingent of entitled right-wing millionaires like Chicken Factory heir Tucker Carlson and the deeply untalented P.J. O'Rourke and dozens of other soft-brained dingbats were attracted to Thompson's later celebrity and buffoonery. While completely ignoring his work, his purpose, his ethics, and his radical, anti-racist, and anti-fascist personal politics that are perfectly illuminated for anyone who can read his work. But that's the past, and while the past is how we got here, it only controls the present if we let it. If we say, oh, it's always that way. Oh, young black and brown men are routinely slaughtered by a lawless brotherhood hiding behind a badge and a gun and the lion's share of our local budgets. The money that should be going to our schools, daycare, parks, libraries, health clinics, job training, the environmental and social work of putting up solar panels on rooftops, building homes for the homeless, making parks out of dirty vacant lots abandoned by the real estate trusts. If we say it's always been that way, and we can't change it, then we're not gonna change it. But if we change it, we will never run out of good things to do with the money that pours into the secretive, violent forces of our towns, cities, and counties. So I want to put a bug in your ear if I can. Get your phone or get on your computer and find out when the primary elections are coming up for all the local and regional offices where you live. Not just this year, but next year. The even-numbered year cycle. Look ahead a little bit. There's always elections coming up. You want to quit giving the school budget to the police? Most school board seats, especially out here in the small towns, are decided by a handful of votes. You got enough friends on Facebook to win a school board race. And no, you don't need any more education or credentials, and you need to become a cop, which is to say none, zero. How about running for town council, the board of supervisors, the water district, the library board? How about running for sheriff? Give that money to the kids, to the grandparents raising toddlers because the mother has to work night shifts at the Walmart, for scholarships to keep any kid who wants to go to community college in community college until they can transfer if they want to a four-year or get the two-year degree and get good, meaningful, full-time work with vacation and benefits doing something that needs to be done, summer camps for kids, trail building for the parks, work on windmills and solar power, retrofitting public buildings and water supplies to make them clean and safe. I mean, the sky is the limit. You can do it. Don't take any guff from these scum. As Hunter Thompson would say, take charge. If it's broke, fix it. Thanks for listening, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Please remember that these are classic episodes, so any events Ken mentioned are long in the past. Anyway, thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thank you for listening and supporting KGVM. We'll be talking about ghost towns this summer. Do you have a favorite? You can leave me a voicemail or text about that or anything else on your mind at 406-404-6246. This program is broadcast on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and it streams online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. See you next week, and happy summer solstice.